Well, good morning.
Morning.
What a joy this is. I have been eager to meet the congregation that had the great good sense to hire Ellen Devenport. And not only that, but to keep her so happy. We are very close friends, and I know how much she enjoys being here, and I was eager to meet your energy. Although I must say, I'm also well aware of how difficult it is to follow Ellen. Yeah. As an associate in Dallas, I often had to do that, and it often felt like people had come to hear Gladys Knight and had to settle for a pip. You know? And I'm not surprised, but she will hear about it, that she chose to allow me to break in the new sound system in case anything went wrong. But it is great to be here. I was going through the Austin airport yesterday and saw those T-shirts, and I thought I must get one on my way back that say, "Keep Austin Weird." And it occurred to me that my message this morning is kind of keep unity weird. We need to embrace our weirdness. If by weird we mean, much as Austin means, a stream of energy that is different than the mainstream of energy, that is significant in different ways, that honors the individual ways in which people express instead of asking them to be part of a larger picture, a larger group. And my premise with the work that I've been doing recently, I did a 5-day workshop last summer on this topic and then just did a workshop at National Conference, is that I have to say this without sounding, you know, judgmental, because I know Ellen never sounds judgmental. Unity has spent a lot of its 120 plus years trying very hard to justify itself in terms of mainstream Christianity. That made a lot of sense for a long time. The whole nation was pretty much mainstream Christian at the time. And there was that sense of not wanting to be weird, you know, not wanting to be out of step. So the emphasis was very much on, we're a lot like you, just a little bit different. You know, we do our church services exactly like you do, and we, you know, we use the Bible the same way you do. Well, maybe not the same way, but we use the same Bible. That counts, you know. And it's never entirely worked for me. Then there are people in Unity, of course, who, and I understand there are maybe 1.5 to 3 here, who would be happy if the word Jesus never crossed our platform or our lips, you know, and would be happy if the Bible disappeared off the planet altogether. If you know me at all, you know that Bible is a passion of mine. I do our Bible program on Unity FM every week, and I have one book out on the Sermon on the Mount, and I have another book coming out in November on the Revelation to John. So I have a real passion for approaching the Bible from our perspective, but from our perspective. I want it to be meaningful to what we believe. And I started working with some of the materials that we've only had for about 60 years, the materials from the Dead Sea Scrolls and especially the Nag Hammadi find in Egypt. And I'm sure you're familiar with that, where they found a shepherd out looking for firewood, found buried in the ground a huge earthen urn that contained a tremendous number of scrolls. And he actually burned some of them for fuel before it occurred to him that there might be some value to them. I know. If you want to make a Bible expert cry, talk about this, you know, talk about what might have been on those scrolls. But from him, we found a whole wealth of material that had been destroyed. And from that, and it's taken 60 years to meticulously to preserve the scrolls, to restore them, to open them, to translate them to fill it. So it's only now that we're beginning to get a real sense of what it contains. And what it contains to me is a beautiful and powerful and exciting indication that Christianity has always been weird. There has always been a strain in Christianity. And that that's fine. I want to look at three particular Gospels today, and here's the basic premise that I have. You know, it begins with Jesus, with his ministry, with his demonstrations, which we understand to be demonstrations of Christ's power. Demonstrations not so that we would be impressed by him and build him churches, but so that we would be challenged by him to go and do what he is doing. You know, he never said, go tell people what I'm doing. He said, see what I'm doing, go and do it. Go and heal the sick. Go and feed the hungry. Go and free the imprisoned. Go and make a difference in the world. And that is what unity must be about. Now, one of the Gospels the Gospel that I start with, and the Gospel that sort of formed all of this for me, is known as the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. And Mary Magdalene, we understand, was a much, much more significant person than she's been given credit for in traditional Christianity. And it has nothing to do with whether she and Jesus ever got it on or got married or had kids or anything else. Because that doesn't lift her at all, does it? If her only importance is her relationship to Jesus, we're kind of missing the point. The point of the fragments, we don't have much of the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, is that she was clearly a spiritual power in herself. And what's really clear is that she was the one person that really got Jesus, that really understood what he was saying. And there's great significance, I think, to the fact that throughout the story of the crucifixion and the resurrection and the tomb, the one consistent that every Gospel agrees on is that Mary Magdalene was there every step of the way. Where everybody else fled, she was there. Where no one else knew what was going on, she was there. And she was there, I am convinced, not just holding witness, not mourning. She was there holding the high watch. She was there waiting for him to finish the demonstration. She knew what he was doing. She was there to support him and to wait for that rock to roll away and for Jesus to prove what he wanted to prove, which is that there is nothing to fear in death, that it is a part of change. And as we just affirmed in prayer, change is a good thing. It's an essential thing. If we don't change, we're not growing in spiritual awareness. So Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene begins with Mary Magdalene and Peter and some other disciples meeting and talking to Jesus post-resurrection before he leaves. And what's clear is that instantly, I mean, his last words are, everybody play nice, you know, be nice to each other. And he's barely out the door before they're at each other's throats. You know, and Peter is saying, we're not going to listen to a woman. Why should we listen to a woman? And they go two different ways. Fine. I think that's fine. I think our mistake is in trying to follow the way of Peter with the energy of Mary Magdalene, instead of saying our Christianity, our understanding of Jesus is a different path altogether. It's not the same as this path, only slightly different, and we can waste a lot of energy trying to follow this path. Peter was very much about organizing a church, combining the new energy into the existing Jewish traditions, working with the synagogues. That's why John Shelby Spong's most recent book talks a lot about the fact that the Gospels, that the four Gospels that are included in the Bible, are designed to fit into a Jewish liturgical year and a Jewish service, so that there was a lot of energy toward including this as part of Judaism. Mary Magdalene, Thomas, other disciples who sort of disappear, never to be heard from again in the mainstream church, went off to themselves. They had a different understanding of Jesus. They had an understanding of Jesus as a mystic, calling us to a mystical teaching, calling us to a personal experience of the divine. Not an experience that depends on a hierarchy, not a relationship that women are only a part of if they're married to a man, not anything that puts anything between us and the divine, but a personal, immediate connection to the divine. And we absolutely need to embrace that more passionately and more fearlessly than we do. I can still get... See, this is where I get in trouble. I can still get annoyed at the Daily Word, for example, because sometimes it creates a separation, doesn't it? That it's very difficult if you're trying to work with this, with the church path. It's very difficult not to get into a God out there kind of belief system. It's really difficult to keep that away. But if you follow this mystical system, there's never a question of separation. It is completely oneness. It is completely about ourselves as expressions of the divine, ourselves as indeed the divine. And I think that unity needs to embrace that more, because I think the rest of the world is beginning to catch on. We can turn to Buddhism, we can turn to some more mainstream Christian thought, and we can find a growing awareness. You know, the idea of the Christ within was very unique and new when unity was founded in the late 19th century. Today, that's not so new. You can find Baptists who would understand what that meant. You know, they might see it differently, but they would understand what it meant. We need to be, if we're going to be on the cutting edge of this spiritual transformation that I passionately believe is upon us, we need to be willing to claim who we are and to claim what we believe. I can go on. Well, I mean, obviously, I did a 5-day retreat, so some of you are going, oh, geez, I hope he's not going to go through the whole... No, I'm not. But I do want to touch on some highlights from those three Gospels. The Gospel of Thomas, many of you are familiar with, I'm sure. It's been around longer than the others. It's been around since the mid-50s. These are all documents that were destroyed by order of the church. So what happened was we had these two paths, and for 300 years, that was fine. Both of them thrived, both of them did their own thing, and nobody got too upset about it. The decisive factor was in the 4th century, early 4th century, when Constantine, the emperor of Rome, converted to Christianity. And all of a sudden, this church stream had the whole weight of the Roman Empire on its behalf. And Rome loved to be organized, and they loved to be absolute. So Constantine said, get your act together, decide what we believe, and get rid of everything else. As a result, the whole mystical path got erased. That's when the word went out to destroy all the books that were not considered acceptable by the church. And that's when I'm absolutely convinced some poor little schmuck of a monk who'd been writing, copying this stuff all his entire life, could not bring himself to burn it all. So he put it in a jug and buried it in the ground and thought, I hope someone finds that someday. And someone did. When we were ready to hear it, someone did. Because don't hear me attacking the church as it exists. It's an important and wonderful and powerful process. It's a step in our spiritual evolution. We all, I'm sure, owe gratitude toward our churches of origin. The world of music, the world of art would be lost without all of the inspiration and the support and the understanding and the love that the church has given. So it's not this or that. It's just claiming ourselves as a different and unique path rather than trying to justify ourselves in terms of this path all the time. That's getting kind of old, isn't it? You know, don't you get kind of tired of telling your traditional friends just how it's different and how it's the same? And, you know, I used to say unity is the only thing that defines itself in negatives. You know, well, we're not really a church. Well, we're kind of a church, but we're not exactly. We don't really. Well, we teach kind of. Well, we never mind. You know, just never mind. We need to be able to know who we are and to say this is who we are. This is what we believe. We affirm our oneness with the divine. We affirm a spiritual purpose in being on this planet to be that oneness in expression, to create a new consciousness, to create a new dimension of experience that Jesus describes as the kingdom of heaven. That's our belief. And we didn't make it up. You know, the Fillmores didn't sit down over dinner and make this up one day and decide to call it unity. It's part of an ancient tradition. And this mystical path never went away. It went way underground because every time it surfaced, somebody got burned at the stake or put in jail for their trouble. You know, St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila. There's a whole stream of Christian mysticism, and we need to embrace that stream and be who we are. This is from the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. Just a little fragment. Peter said to him, "Since you have become the interpreter of the elements and the events of the world, tell us, what is the sin of the world?" The teacher answered, "There is no sin. It is you who make sin exist when you act according to the habits of your corrupted nature. That is where sin lies." That's a mystical understanding that we make these things up ourselves. If we believe in sin, we punish ourselves by consciously committing sin, consciously making a choice that goes against what we know to be true. From the Gospel of Thomas, this first one is probably the clearest, shortest description of the spiritual process that I'm sure many of you have experienced that I have ever found. Jesus said, "The seeker should not stop until he finds. When he finds, he will be disturbed. After having been disturbed, he will be astonished. Then he will reign over everything." So when you find, and this doesn't happen just once. You know, this is part of a process that I work with a lot as the hero's journey. And we're involved in many hero's journeys at the same time. And we, as soon as we finish one, we're getting restless and ready to start another one. You know, so it goes on and on and on. So every time you find yourself disturbed, what you generally say is, "Ooh, there must be something wrong with this path I'm on. I should try, you know, Buddhism, or I should try go back to the Baptist church, or I should be a Catholic again," or whatever you want to do. Disturbed is part of the process. Disturbed means you're on your way. Disturbed is our first reaction to a new awareness that is going to require us to change. Then, if we stick with it through the disturbed, we will become astonished at the implications. And part of that astonishment usually is saying, "Well, duh, isn't it?" You know, it's like, "Well, why didn't I know that before? That's so obvious. Why was I fighting it? Why was I resisting it? Why was I so disturbed? This is a good thing." And then we own it all. Then we own our power. Then we realize that we are not victims of anything or anyone on this planet. And if that's our spiritual purpose, that gives us, I think, a lot to work with, you know? That we want to free this world from the whole idea of being victims. Jesus, this is one that, because people sometimes say, "Well, if we're not a church, why do we come together on Sundays?" Jesus said, "If two can make peace between themselves in a single house, they can say to a mountain, 'Move,' and it will move." Now, that's a little different than the version in Mark, isn't it? He's not saying, "If you believe, you can do that." He's saying, "If you come together, if you work together and overcome your differences." So maybe when we come together, now I'm sure that, especially under Ellen's benevolent and kind leadership, that there has never been a conflict or challenge in this congregation. But believe it or not, in some unity churches there are issues. You know, there are issues. This invites us to see that that doesn't mean we're doing something wrong. That means we're doing it. Because it's in being willing to work through the issues. It's in being willing to love each other through our differences, to come together and see what happens when we bring our differences into one place. That's the purpose that brings us together, to learn how to love. So that, you know, the fact that we have differences doesn't mean that there's something wrong with the church and we should fire the minister or we should get a new board or we should something, you know, whatever churches decide to do. It means we should hunker down and work through it. We should hunker down and love one another and honor each other for the differences we are, because that's what we're here to do. Jesus said, I love this, when the kingdom of the Father is like a woman who was carrying a jar full of grain. As she walked along, a handle of her jar broke off and grain trickled out, but she didn't notice. When she arrived in her house, she put the jar down and found it empty. That's a very Eastern. In fact, there's a story very much like that in Hindu scripture. And what's interesting is that it doesn't make the woman wrong, does it? He says the kingdom of heaven is like a woman who is carrying a jar full of grain and doesn't notice that it's leaking out. And by the time she gets home, by the time she gets to where she's going, the grain is gone. That's how we're to live our lives. Letting our good, letting our love trickle out in ways that we don't even notice. Not big things, just little things, just minor things, just letting love sprinkle along behind us. We're supposed to get to the end of life with an empty jar. We're not supposed to get there saying, look, I saved all my love and didn't give it to anybody, so can I get into heaven now? You know, because the answer will be, no, go back and try again. You know, and I don't want to go through junior high again. This is one of my mantras. I barely made it through puberty the first time. I am not doing that again. I am not. So it's about, you know, when I was growing up, we would go to my grandmother's house, and it was 25 miles away, which at that time was a long drive. We would all get in the car and drive. And we'd pull up in front, and my mother would turn around from the back seat, and she would say, don't touch anything. Say hello to your grandmother, go through the house, into the backyard, play in the backyard, don't touch anything. Because my grandmother's house was full of tchotchkes and things and, you know, statues and beer steins and just all kinds of things that a kid would like. When I went down there to stay for like a week in the summer, the rules were completely different. My grandmother loved me to pick things up so that she could tell the story about where it came from or how she happened to have it. And if I put it down someplace different, what's the big difference? Don't we often act like we're supposed to get through life so that at the end it looks like we've never been there? You know, we've not made any change. We've just been obedient. We've done what we were told. We left everything exactly where it was. We've made it to the end. No. Jesus is saying, pick it up. Play with it. Use it. Try it out. If you break it, there's more. Don't worry about it. Be involved. Be engaged. Make a difference so that when you come to the end, you have an empty jar and you can report a really successful and satisfied life. I just marked a few of these. It's interesting. Every time I go to them, I see different ones that I want to share. So that's the gospel of Thomas, and that's the gospel of Mary Magdalene. The really interesting one for me is the gospel of Philip, which is 300 years later. So it's not a gospel that tells the story of the life of Jesus. It tells the story of a teacher of Jesus named Philip and the way in which he understood, interpreted, and taught the ministry of Jesus. And one of his favorite images of our relationship to the divine is the image of a bridal chamber. And, you know, there's no one in a bridal chamber but the bride and the groom. There's no church. You know, there's no authority figure telling you how to do it. There's the giver and the receiver of love. And it's an intimate, quiet, private place where you can express your union. He says, what is the bridal chamber if not the place of trust and consciousness in the embrace? It is an icon of union beyond all forms of possession. Here is where the veil is torn from top to bottom. Here is where some arise and awaken. And what about dealing with the rest of the world? Philip says, the powers can do nothing against those who are clothed in light. They cannot see them. All will be clothed in light when they enter into the mystery of the sacred embrace. So if we are clothed in light, if we are truly one with our divinity, if we are truly surrendered to that Christ guidance within us, we become invisible to the rest of the world. You may remember, I don't know what, 15 years ago maybe now, the Celestine Prophecy, when everybody was reading that. And I think the ninth insight, it's not my favorite book. I used to call it The Hardy Boys Do Metaphysics, but... But its ninth insight is that as we progress in spiritual awareness, we become progressively invisible. And I thought, not in this life, you know, let's get real. Then I thought about it. And, you know, you were talking about, what, reverse blessings? That's the nicest way I've ever heard anybody put it. My path, my unconscious participation on a spiritual path involved a lot of drugs and alcohol, and my entry into consciousness began with the 12-step programs. And to those people with whom I used to drink and drug, I'm invisible. And they're invisible to me. We don't live in the same world anymore. You know, we just don't. Our paths never cross. It's been years since I've run across anybody that, you know, that remembers me from those days. So spiritually, I think we do become invisible, don't you? I think our vibration quickens, and we become visible to those people whose vibration level is similar to ours, and to others, we don't. And that's what I hear him saying here. You know, you're going to be persecuted, you're going to be judged, other people are going to find you weird. But if you really continue to link to your truth, they won't even see you after a while. They won't even wonder what you're up to. They won't get upset by it because they won't feel threatened by it. So you'll be able to do your work and to join with, I think of the book, Ken Carey's book from a number of years ago called Return of the Bird Tribes. And that was what I see happening everywhere now, because he talks about finding your tribe. Not because your tribe is better than everybody else's, but because you need to work with your tribe. And I think a tribe could be defined as those people who are vibrating at your level of vibration. Those people that you can work with because you understand each other, and you know each other, and you support each other, and you can speak the same language, and you can get things done more quickly. And if that doesn't define a unity center, then then we need to rethink what a unity center is all about. I think that does define it. I think you demonstrate that. I think Unity of Greater Hartford demonstrates that on a very powerful basis. There's always more work to do. But I think that finding our tribe is what brings us together on a Sunday morning, or brings us together. You know, we do a Friday night coffee house, to which you have a standing invitation, by the way, both of you. And thank you. You know, the Great American Songbook is my definition of spiritual music. So all the whole prologue today was just absolutely wonderful. Whatever it is we choose to do. We have a softball team. We have a bowling team. We do all kinds of things in the community. They think we're weird. You know, talk about weird. I had to tell my softball team, I said, it's wonderful to be happy for the other team when they score. But it's really, you really need to stop applauding long enough to catch the ball. You can't be so happy for them that you don't catch the ball. Catch the ball. Putting our principles to work can be challenging, you know, but we're getting there. So what I'm trying to do, I guess, is to focus us on appreciating who we are. Unity is an astonishing, wonderful gift to each of us. You know, I really believe that the very fact that we are here this morning means that we are part of this spiritual transformation that is happening. Means that on some level, we came here to be part of this crazy world that we're living in, because it sounded like fun. Yeah, we're crazy people. We're weird. You know, we said, oh, sure, we'll go in and change the world. Go in and change consciousness? Yeah, sounds like fun. Sign me up. You know. I had a fortune teller kind of person who did a reading on me, and she said, you came in without grounding yourself at all. You didn't. You just came in and you discovered you didn't know how anything worked. You didn't read the instruction book. I said, I've never read an instruction book in my life. You know, but have you, anybody here relate to that? I got here thinking everybody else read an instruction book that I was not given. You know, I do not know how this works. And now I've got to spend all my energy trying to hide the fact that I don't know how anything works. I still do that around my IT people, for example. I have 5 buttons I can comfortably touch on my computer. Everything else, I just pretend I know what's going on. And my computer just sits there and snarls at me because it knows that I don't know. We came to be part of this. Unity is a part of our awakening. The awakening calls us to fully and completely know who we are and not waver from it, not try to compromise it, not be talked out of it, and not really try to share it with other people. You know, we can't. That's one of the gifts of unity, I think, is we don't go out and put our foot in the door and try to tell people that they need to join unity. We are glad that we are here. We want to be sure that everybody who is part of our tribe knows where we are and how to find us and that they're drawn into our doors. That will give us all the power, the abundance, the love that we need. Because the bottom line message of the Gospel of Philip is that this creative energy that we are here to express is love. That is the name of it. That is the essence of it. That is the purpose of it. That is the feeling of it. That is how we express it. It is not what we hold in mind that creates. It's what we hold in heart. It's not necessarily what we believe or have been told we believe. It's what we love. We create according to what we love. And the love I feel here this morning by itself could create the kingdom of heaven. We can do that. We can do that. And the more opportunities we have to share with each other and to come down here and to have, you know, come up to Connecticut and to travel around and to appreciate what a wonderful energy we have, there are going to be more and more opportunities for that. I certainly hope this isn't the last time I see these wonderful faces before me. And it's just a joy to be here this morning. Let's take this into a moment of meditation, and let's just center ourselves in this message, in this possibility, before we move on. So we begin by comfortably settling our bodies, setting aside any distractions we may have with us. Feeling completely supported by the chair beneath us, so there is no need for any tension in our bodies. Feeling completely supported by the energy of love that fills this room, so there is no need for any resistance, any tension in our minds. Breathing deeply of that energy of love and allowing it to guide our inner focus from all the busyness of thoughts scurrying for attention in our mind up to what Jesus calls the upper room, to the heart center of our being, to that place from which we can see all and feel ourselves intimately and completely one with the light and love of the divine. From this heart perspective, we look back on the path that has brought us to this moment, a path of shadows and light, joys and sorrows. And we can see that however chaotic it seemed, it expresses from this heart perspective as a beautiful pattern of infinite possibility leading us to this very moment. And so to every challenge, to every opportunity, to every person who has been a challenge or a support, we send this heart energy back in deep gratitude for all that brought us here. Then we turn and see the path from here leading back down into the busyness of mind and through and beyond, and it turns a corner and passes from our sight, but we know that it continues to hold shadows and light, challenges and opportunities, joys and sorrows, and we know that we carry our own innate divinity with us as we move forward into this day, into this week, into everything that remains of this life experience for each of us. And that at any point, when the shadows feel overwhelming, when the challenges seem to be insurmountable obstacles, at any point we can come back to this heart perspective and see differently and send this Christ energy forward before us to guide us on the path. It's all good. It's all God. It's all us. And for the privilege of the spiritual work that is ours to do, we say, thank you, God. Thank you, God. Thank you, God. And amen.